This is The Takeaway with MHP from WNYC and PRX in collaboration with GBH News in Boston.
The Supreme Court decision overturning Roe v. Wade and ending the constitutional right to abortion could have meaningful repercussions on assisted reproductive technology, including in vitro fertilization, or IVF. Some fertility experts worry that the existing language in state laws could complicate or even limit the choices of would-be parents. We talk with someone navigating these concerns.
My name is Stephanie. I live in Minneapolis. I moved there almost 10 years ago from Kentucky with my husband because that's where the jobs are.
When Stephanie and her husband first got married, they didn't plan to have children, but those plans changed.
When I turned 33, I was sort of like, oh my gosh, I'm a mom. I need to be a mom.
Stephanie is now 38, and she and her husband have been trying to get pregnant for a few years.
It's kind of ironic because I spent my 20s not trying to get pregnant, and I have spent my 30s trying to get pregnant.
But they face some delays and complications. Before the pandemic, doctors found a fibroid in her uterus that was the size of a baseball, and she couldn't get it removed once the pandemic began because it was considered an elective surgery.
May of last year, I had the fibroid removed. We ended up getting pregnant the first time that we tried this past November, which ended in a miscarriage. And so we've been trying ever since to get pregnant. We started seeing a fertility specialist in March of this year, and we are on our second round of IUI, which is intrauterine insemination. And I actually am waiting to find out if I am pregnant. If I am not, we will do one more round of IUI. And if that doesn't work, then we will start with IVF.
IVF is one of the most widely known forms of assisted reproductive technology, or ART. Assisted reproduction plays a role in about 2% of all births in the United States. And there's a lot of uncertainty around how the Supreme Court decision ending the constitutional right to an abortion will affect state regulations regarding IVF. Many states with new abortion laws define personhood at the moment of fertilization. And it's unclear if states will place restrictions on the handling of embryos in fertility labs. Alabama is one state that's made it clear that fertility clinics would not be subjected to penalty for discarding or manipulating embryos in fertility labs, as embryos outside of the womb do not have the same rights as those inside the womb. But for states who have not yet made this distinction, the future of fertility clinics and IVF practices remains unclear.
You know, it's really scary not knowing if, number one, if what I'm doing is going to be judged. you know, I'm not a Christian. And, you know, if people want to believe what they believe about when conception occurs, I think that that's great. But, you know, I don't understand why it needs to be something that has such a deep effect on me trying to have a family.
Well, Stephanie lives in Minnesota, where Democratic lawmakers have said they will protect abortion rights. But as you heard, the uncertainty surrounding abortion laws following the Roe decision has unnerved her. And other state laws could affect the ability for future IVF patients to opt for selective reduction. That's a common practice to decrease embryos in the womb in the case of multiples.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly emotional, you know? Hearing stories about pregnant women on the news, you know, every single day is, it drums up a lot more of the emotions. It's just almost more complicated.
The Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade leaves the future of abortion in the hands of states. It's also created uncertainty when it comes to those using IVF to conceive. Some states, including Texas and Kentucky, ban the termination of a pregnancy once an egg is fertilized. And while those laws include some provisions allowing for medical providers to perform procedures if the mother's life or health is severely at risk, it's unlikely IVF patients in these states would still have the option for procedures like selective reduction. This procedure is common practice in IVF and involves terminating embryos in the womb, often due to chromosome abnormalities or the financial, emotional, or health consequences of a pregnancy of multiples. Joining me now is Dr. Kim Thornton, Director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, and a reproductive endocrinologist at Boston IVF. Dr. Thornton, thanks for being here on The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm also joined by Dr. Louise King, an ethicist and surgeon who serves as Director of Reproductive Bioethics at the Harvard Medical School's Center for Bioethics and Vice Chair of the Ethics Committee of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Thanks to you as well for being with us, Dr. King.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Dr. King, I want to begin with you. You're a bioethicist and earned a law degree before becoming a physician. Can you just weigh in a bit on the legal perspective of what you see in the context of the Dobbs decision that can affect the issue of assisted reproductive technologies or ART?
In terms of the legality of proceeding forward with IVF, of course, it's still technically legal, but some of the sequela of IVF, notably perhaps needing abortion services in the context of a miscarriage, but still with electrical activity, and by that I mean, quote unquote, a heartbeat, can be called into question in some of our states now. And so the safety of proceeding with IVF may also be called into question in those states.
I want to think a bit about this. And for folks who haven't engaged with assisted reproductive technologies, it can feel like either a scary world or a kind of closed world or one that is, you know, either super scientific or medical in some kinds of ways. So, Dr. Thornton, can you just maybe walk us a bit through the moments in the context of IVF and other assisted reproductive technologies where the issues of termination, you know, really come up, sort of how they undergird some of what happens in ART?
You know, when you think about in vitro fertilization procedures, you know, we see couples with a number of different types of reasons they might seek fertility care. And the couples are very thoughtful in terms of deciding to pursue IVF. The IVF procedure involves taking medications that stimulate the ovaries. We then retrieve eggs, fertilize them with sperm, and create embryos. And one of the advances in terms of IVF is we've gotten very sophisticated in being able to grow embryos to the blastocyst stage, which improves the likelihood of embryo implantation. We are able to do genetic testing of embryos in some instances where couples might be carriers of genetic conditions, which again requires manipulation of embryos. And from the standpoint of, you know, IVF and, you know, the risk with this recent decision is whether or not IVF could become potentially more complicated if there were restrictions placed on fertility care and how we might deliver that care.
I asked Dr. Thornton about some of the decisions within IVF treatment that might become more restricted depending on state law.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, we're fortunate that, you know, at least in the U.S. and in certain states in particular, IVF services are readily available. But any sort of restrictions to IVF would limit the access to care that many patients might need. So for instance, if you were a carrier of a genetic condition, you and your partner were a carrier of a genetic condition, you know, IVF with genetic testing is one of the things that we can offer. That may be something that's not necessarily accessible. We've also made great strides in terms of being able to offer single embryo transfer to reduce the risk of conceiving a twin pregnancy or even a triplet pregnancy. But with that comes other things such as, again, culturing embryos out to blastocysts, freezing embryos, and transferring one embryo at a time that might be more difficult to patients moving forward.
So, Dr. King, I want to come to you on this. It's also the case that assisted reproductive technology is not inexpensive. And even when portions of it are covered by, you know, employer-provided health insurance, typically those of us who found ourselves in the IVF realm are people of at least relative means and often of substantial means. And I'm wondering if there's also this sense, a kind of shrug that says, well, I mean, if you can afford to do IVF, then you'll be able to afford to travel to New York and stay for 2 days or travel to California in order to make these kinds of termination decisions if it comes to that sort of post-transfer. And therefore, thinking that maybe this doesn't have that same kind of effect. I'm wondering, Dr. King, if you still see, even for those people of means, real danger in the Dobbs decision for the availability and access to IVF.
Of course, the Dobbs decision disproportionately affects persons of color, and it's really important for us to emphasize that. And it should be noted that most estimates say that only 12% of those persons in the United States who could benefit from assisted reproduction can actually access it in this country. So that's another huge problem. But even in the context of your excellent point, which is that people who are able to access assisted reproduction can, to some degree or another, afford it, many of those people are on their, you know, mortgaging homes, really stretching themselves very thin just to be able to afford this. So to think that they could then also add in the cost of travel and lost opportunities for employment and all the emotional burden of having to navigate that, leaving a state in which something is illegal, crossing state lines, et cetera. That's a lot to ask of anyone, even of somebody with means, and it should not be something that any of the citizens of this country should face. So I would still say it's exceptionally problematic and incredibly myopic of the Supreme Court not to have considered all these ramifications and all the interstate regulations of Commerce Clause, et cetera, that come into play here that they've referenced in some of their footnotes, but essentially ignored.
Dr. Thornton, I want to think a little bit about practitioners. So we've been talking to abortion providers, and I think some folks might feel is either completely different from or even opposed to those who are operating in the space of IVF, right? People working really hard to reproduce versus those who, for whatever sets of reasons, may need to terminate and not reproduce in that moment in their lives. I'm wondering, though, for the experience of practitioners, if it feels like, oh, you know, I'm an IVF practitioner that's I'm in total opposition to or completely alien to what's going on with abortion practitioners, or if there is more a sense of all being within a similar space of reproductive rights.
Well, I think one of the concerns that providers of fertility care have is, while, you know, we are certainly in the business of building families, we're also creating embryos. And there's the concern that the language surrounding abortion may be misconstrued or misstated and then inadvertently be applied to, for instance, embryos, which, you know, are sitting in the laboratory. And, you know, so that's one of the issues, I think, that currently, you know, none of the states or none of the laws within the states have included IVF or included any discussion about embryo disposition. But I think that, you know, that's one of the concerns that fertility providers have, is that there may be some misrepresentation of the language and, you know, inadvertently include disposition of embryos in that language. Similarly, inclusion of manipulation of embryos or anything like that is also a concern that fertility providers have.
Are there ways that fertility providers and practitioners might be able to mitigate some of the effects of Dobbs in the short term while some of this is still being worked out, sort of, you know, week to week, month to month? You know, there's this kind of long range view, but I keep thinking there's somebody whose, you know, appointment was scheduled today in, you know, in a state where Dobbs changed the law, you know, on Friday or over the weekend. I've been thinking about those families and what they're facing.
You know, I think in most of the states currently, IVF is legal in all 50 states, and it's unlikely in the short term that provision of fertility care will be impacted. But again, I think we're looking at making sure that there's no kind of manipulation of language, you know, or creating definitions that don't necessarily, you know, that overreach, if you will. You know, our business is to really help individuals build their families, right? And, you know, that's our goal, helping them do that in a very safe way. So, you know, when you talk about, you know, the strides that we've made towards single embryo transfer, genetic testing, so we have healthy embryos that we're transferring back, all of those things have really advanced the safety of IVF. And so hopefully, you know, those practices won't come into question and get wrapped into this abortion discussion.
All right, one more quick pause, and then we're back with how the Supreme Court decision could affect assisted reproductive technology in just a moment.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're back with The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. I've been speaking with Dr. Kim Thornton and Dr. Louise King about how the overturning of Roe v. Wade could affect assisted reproductive technologies like IVF. If personhood laws recognize embryos outside of the womb as having rights, practices in fertility clinics, such as discarding or manipulating embryos in a lab, could be subject to even stricter regulations, regulations which could make it impossible to go forward with the assisted reproductive technologies. Now, states with some of the strictest abortion laws, like Oklahoma, do not explicitly mention exemptions for assisted reproductive technologies in their legislation. So the effect of the laws on IVF procedures is still unclear. More than a decade ago, in 2011, Mississippi voters struck down a personhood amendment, which would have recognized that life begins at fertilization. Opponents to the amendment were concerned it would have ramifications for IVF practices, such as disposing of unused fertilized eggs. So I asked Dr. King if that kind of discourse about personhood and the ways it might affect assisted reproductive technologies could be valuable in this moment.
The efforts to create a personhood amendment would have created a status of person for an embryo, which would have incredibly far-reaching effects, not just essentially outlawing IVF entirely, because, of course, you would not be able to create multiple embryos at once, because you would have to have a very clear plan for every single embryo as a person. And then each embryo would be subject to custody laws and tax laws and inheritance laws. As you explore the concept of personhood from an ethics standpoint, as well as its parallel concepts of the moral status of embryos, the fetus, a child, a person, you will come to realize that from an ethics standpoint, an embryo obviously cannot be a person. But frankly, neither could a newborn child, because personhood requires, from an ethics standpoint, much more simply than a genetic connection. A fairly decent argument as a mother of a teenager could be made that full personhood doesn't even occur until your mid-20s. What I've found, unfortunately, in having these discussions with thousands of students and people, is that they have to be open to an understanding of personhood and moral status beyond whatever their theological approach to it might be. So the current Dobbs decision is based on a Christian fundamentalist theological approach to when life occurs. There are many members of our community who do not share that view, myself obviously included. And my belief comes from the Jewish tradition, which holds that that status would attach at birth. But again, from a philosophical standpoint, as you approach personhood, through some of the most influential writings, there are so many criterion that can come into defining when someone has really truly reached that level of sentience that it surely wouldn't happen until sometime after birth.
Dr. Thornton, let me come back to you. Sort of walking back a bit to the point about assisted reproductive technologies and relative wealth or status or income, acknowledging that many people are absolutely stretching, going into debt in order to try to make families. You're a member of the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Task Force of the ASRM. Can you talk to me a little bit about how Dobbs, not only on the question of abortion, but on IVF, might also have some effects around issues of diversity and racial justice relative to access to assisted reproductive technologies?
Certainly. You know, I think that a lot of this will depend on what ultimate impact Dobbs has on the IVF industry. So I could envision an instance where IVF might become more complicated, where we might be restricted in terms of creating multiple embryos and have to create one embryo at a time. You know, that would make it very, very difficult for couples who would then need to potentially do multiple cycles to afford care, very different from being able to do one IVF cycle, create multiple embryos, and have embryos available for transfer that are already created and stored in our cryo tanks. It may limit access to fertility care in certain states. And, you know, if you look at where, you know, minority populations may be concentrated, right, within the United States, mm-hmm. that may limit access to care in certain states, and they're not going to be able to travel for 2 to 3 weeks to stay in a state where they can access fertility care. So I think it could have a huge impact on, you know, access to care for minority communities in particular, as well as those with who have limited resources.
I want to just ask from each of you a final question here. So, Dr. Thornton, I just want to, I'm wondering if there is something that you have learned in the practice of assisted reproductive technologies, less in the science and more in the like, what it takes to make family in this way that might help us in the culture, in the discourse, as we are trying to talk about the multiple interests here in a way that reflects being on the same side rather than opposing sides?
Certainly. You know, I think from my perspective, you know, family building is a very intimate personal experience between patients and their provider. And when outside forces start to interfere with the decisions that you might make when patients are having discussions with their physicians, it's very difficult to navigate. And I think that providers are going to have difficulty with that, as are, you know, the patients who are coming to seek care, right? Most patients want to have healthy pregnancies, and they are looking to us as providers to use the best scientific evidence that we have to help them make those decisions. And these are not political decisions in my mind, they are personal decisions. And I think that it's important that we're mindful of that when we go forward.
And Dr. King, I guess I want to ask something similar. And I'm wondering if you could just educate the audience a bit on the Ninth Amendment and how you read that relative to Dobbs.
Absolutely. And to build on what Dr. Thornton just said, the Ninth Amendment essentially codifies the fact that as persons, all of us as citizens of the United States wish to have the ability to make decisions about our own bodies, about our life, our liberty, and our pursuit of happiness, free from unnecessary and inappropriate control from outside forces. And we are guaranteed that right, despite it not being enumerated. So Sam Alito's opinion and his concurring justices were all trying to say that because the word abortion is not contained within our Constitution, it was not contemplated by our founders, and it is not a protected right, or a right to abortion is not a protected right. Of course, our founders were all white men, many slave owners, and they certainly didn't include women in any aspect of our Constitution. So there would have been no reason for them to mention abortion, which in fact was widely practiced at the time. The Ninth Amendment in our Constitution specifically states that even if it hasn't been enumerated, there are inalienable rights that we all hold. And one of those rights is to be left alone in these personal and carefully constructed decisions that we make with our families and our healthcare providers.
I'm so grateful to both of you, Dr. Louise King and Dr. Kim Thornton, for joining us today and walking us through what just is complicated and maybe not something that many people have thought about in this moment. Thank you for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Thank you.